Call the Civil Law Committee to order. Members, quorum is present, and entertain a motion to approve the minutes from, is that Representative Mahoney? Representative Mahoney moves to approve the minutes of 2-9.
Oh, 2-8.
2-8, that's right, the Tuesday night. 2-8, 11 minutes. Any additions or corrections? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Members, we had more bills on today's agenda, and for a variety of reasons, the two common interest community bills, Representative Kahn and Representative Wardlow's, had some things that they were trying to work out yet, and so we agreed to pull them off of our agenda. We've just got Representative Hoppe's bill today, which appears to be non-controversial, and so I don't expect we need to be here more than 20-30 minutes. Put the pressure on the testifiers. They're standing between us and extra office time. Members, feel free to ask questions as needed, but we will adjourn early today, potentially, assuming this bill doesn't have a need to be longer than what I thought it would be. So just FYI. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The only thing I'd ask is in the presenter's presentation that they actually talk about, for some of the new members on the committee, you always want to know about the repealers.
Mm-hmm.
And just so the testifiers could go over a little bit of the repealers.
Okay. Point well taken. I think they heard that. Representative Hoppe, why don't we have you come forward and present your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move House File 382, and it is a bill brought by the State Bar Association dealing with receiverships.
Representative Hoppe moves House File 382 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Judiciary Committee. Why don't you go forward, and if they can walk through what's being repealed and then what's moving. As I understand, we're trying to clean up or consolidate some of these things into a more readable section of law. But go ahead, Representative Hoppe, and your witness.
That is, you have a good description of it, Mr. Chair, and with that I will turn it over to the experts.
Welcome to our committee, if you can identify yourself for the record.
We will. I am James Bailey, B-A-I-L-L-I-E. I practice law with Fredrickson and Byron, and I was the chair of the committee that drafted the bill that you have in front of you. And with me is Kevin Dunleavy, who is a member of the committee as well. And with your permission, then we'll proceed. What I had in mind, Mr. Chair, was to spend about 5 minutes and tell this group briefly what is receivership and assignments for the benefit of creditors. Why we felt there was a need for new statutes.
Mr. Bailey, can I have you just get a little closer to the microphone so it picks up on the record?
Yes. Why this group felt that we needed new statutes, the process that we followed through, that is, who was involved in this and what is the bar process, and then something of what the content is, and I will address the matter of repealers then at the end if that order is acceptable. And if that is consistent with what the chair would like, I would do that in about 5 minutes or so.
You may proceed. That sounds good.
Receiverships are a court-ordered process by which a receiver takes involuntary possession of property of another. It's a common law process that goes back 500 years or so. In our judicial history, it's very common. It seems to have been growing over time and evolving over time as a common law development. Some of the most common uses of receiverships today are mortgage foreclosures on commercial property, not residential property, but commercial property, where there's an effort to collect the rents or secure the property against waste on behalf of the secured creditors. Various kinds of corporate dissolutions, corporations, limited partnerships, and so on, which cannot function, may need a court order giving someone control over them. Various frauds, the Madoff, Petters kinds of situations often begin with the appointment of receiver, in part because that can be done very quickly by a court when that need is perceived. and many others. It also is used frequently in state-regulated industries, but our bill wouldn't touch that. The regulation of banks and insurance companies and the like often use receivers as part of their process. Assignments for the benefit of creditors are also a court-supervised process. The difference is that it's begun voluntarily. A debtor will agree to assign his property or its property to an assignee who will then liquidate the property and distribute it to creditors. And that's supervised, or at least there are statutes that address the supervision of that by court process. It is not a bankruptcy. Neither of these is a bankruptcy process, and the distinctions between those are something we paid attention to. So why do we feel that we need a new statute? Receiverships, as I said, are more and more used. They're coming to courts of general jurisdiction, so the judges there encounter these situations occasionally, but not regularly. There are, although it's a common law developed process, it's more and more common to have our Minnesota statutes make reference to receivers or receiverships, and there are 299 references to receivers or receiverships in our statute, and nowhere is there a general provision describing when receivers should be appointed, what the processes should be about bonds and reports and standards for selection of receivers and items of that type. There is a general rule of practice, Rule 137, that addresses a few of these things. But together, there's no guidance. So the judges are having to figure it out new each time how to do this, and the parties. We felt there was a need to lay out a comprehensive discussion of how to go about receiverships in Minnesota for guidance of the courts and the parties, without an intention of making any changes, or at least not any dramatic changes in the actual practice, but to get them written down so that this is not a matter of lore or custom or tradition, which is not known many times by many of the people who may be involved in the process. Assignments for the benefit of creditors are used very commonly in some other parts of the country and never used in Minnesota because the statute that we have here is not functional. It's a frequent way to go through a foreclosure process or for a troubled business to hand over its assets voluntarily for the benefit of its creditors with the consent of everyone involved, with some court supervision, but it's not used here because our statute is really not functional. This is a bar bill, the process that we used. We started with an informal committee of 17 members whose practices are specialized around receiverships, coming at it from the disciplines of real property, business law, bankruptcy. We had some receivers on the committee. We had 18 meetings, more than 60 hours when all of us were together. In the process early on, we found that Washington had gone through the same process, developed a comprehensive statute addressing the same things. We thought they had done a good job. We borrowed their statute and then addressed each section by section and ended up in different places on particular provisions because we think the law is different here, or the customs are different here, but we learned a lot from that process. So in the bar process, a bill like this, proposed bill, goes through sections. So this was adopted by the business law section and by the real property section, then vetted by the legislative committee for the Bar Association, and ultimately adopted by the assembly, which is the major legislative group. So that's an overview. Now, what did we do? We addressed, and here I think there's some question about how much of this you want to hear, but I'll take just a couple minutes. We addressed basic questions of the power of the court, that is, to make clear that the court supervises this, not the parties, that such as the secured lender that sought the appointment of a receiver. We made distinctions of the kinds of receivership. We recognize that limited that in many situations the role of the receiver is limited only to a kind of a custodial role. In the foreclosure situation that I described, the foreclosure process will ultimately answer the question of when ownership changes hands. But so those we call limited receiver receiverships, and then we have general, which are really for liquidation. They're bankruptcy-like, a Petters or Madoff situation, where property is taken from the fraudster for ultimate distribution to all of the creditors. So with that, we developed, I might say, I think this is important. There's a major section on mortgage foreclosures, which I think is developed over time and has its sort of balance between debtors and creditors. And we decided, although we thought we could improve considerably the language of that and the clarity, we decided, by and large, to leave it alone rather than, you know, evoke the interest of practically everybody in those communities. We did make some minor changes that are described in a report that we have prepared, but we address how receivers are appointed, what their qualifications should be, bonds, the liability, the employment of professionals, creation of schedules, notices, reports, replacement of receivers, and those kind of things, and some basic questions about powers. When they can be sued, where they can be sued, the obligation to turn over receivership property, stays, utility services, contracts, sales free and clear of liens, abandonment of property, and the like. So that's an overview. Of course, I'd be glad to take any particular questions. As I look at the repealer section, which was prepared by the revisor's office, almost all of that is the repealer of 576, which is the basic section that does address something about receivers. That is, 576 subdivision 1 currently describes some of the situations in which they may be appointed. And the same concepts were carried into the new statute. They're reordered a little bit, but we did not intend to make any changes there. And then I mentioned already the appointments and mortgage situations. We didn't intend to make any changes there. The others are the remaining sort of, then starting with 577, those are the odd paragraphs or sections that deal with assignments for the benefit of creditors. And since we're replacing it entirely, those would be repealed. But there, I don't think there's any significant change in concept there. They're just replaced by others in more detail. There's three sections, one in Chapter 302, one in 308, two in 308, that look to me to address particular procedures which would be superseded by our statute. That is, they're in the context of receivership that are ordered under those statutes. And so now the new statute would control. I'd be glad to take any questions.
Any questions, Representative Mahoney or anybody? Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bailey, you used a word in your beginning statement that I find in the bill on page 6, line 31. We're talking about managing the mortgage property so as to prevent waste. Waste seems kind of an interesting term there. Can you describe, is there a legal definition that applies here, or what is meant by that?
Mr. Bailey.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe I can answer that. First, this particular language is really carried over from the old statute, so it's not something that we have added. But historically, the first reason why a secured lender, the holder of a mortgage, for example, would seek a receiver is that the lender had begun a foreclosure process. It takes a certain amount of time to give the proper notice, public notice, and so on. Then there's a foreclosure sale. And in a foreclosure by action, there's a period of redemption in which the debtor maintains ownership of that property. If the lender can demonstrate that there is waste in the property, it's not properly being maintained, sidewalks aren't being shoveled, the utility bills aren't being paid, taxes aren't being paid, and other things, then that could be grounds for the appointment of a receiver on behalf of a secured lender. It is not, there's nowhere a specific definition of this. It's been developed over case law. It is to a large extent, however, superseded by modern forms of mortgages and by language in the statute. The legislature has updated that statute a couple of times to make it easier to get a receiver or to collect the rents, sometimes even without approving a waste. Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Hortman.
Thank you. You know, you just mentioned there's other law that makes it easier to appoint a receiver in a case of a mortgage. Or were you referring to the more modern mortgages? Is there a different receivership section applying to a situation where there's a mortgage where it's going through the redemption?
Well, what?
Mr. Bailey.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hortman. The existing 576.01 subdivision 2 deals with mortgage foreclosures, and there's yet another section that deals with assignments for rent, which is a related topic. And over time, that statute has been changed two or three times over the last 30 or 40 years to strengthen the position of secured lenders in the foreclosure process. We carried that section over into the new section almost without change. We recognize that there's a kind of a balance there that has been created between lenders and borrowers, and that if we tried to make changes there, we would attract a lot of excitement around the bill when our intention was not to deal with the substance, but to get a good process through. So we really didn't change that. We did make a couple of changes when we moved the procedure out. If a lender wants to get a receiver, the lender needs to make a motion. That can be done on an expedited basis, but then there needs to be a later hearing, much like a temporary restraining order or injunctive process. And it was somewhat in the bill, not that in the existing statute, not that clear. We moved it into another section so that would apply to receiverships in all circumstances. And we clarified something about the receiver's obligation to pay tenant deposits, insurance, and state real estate taxes, and gave the receiver the discretion to make those payments, which have to be made so long as they're funds, in whatever order is most protective of the property.
Just a follow-up, Mr.
Representative
Chair.
Hortman.
I'm intrigued because a significant issue in my community of Brooklyn Park is properties going through the foreclosure, the redemption period, and, you know, maybe mom and dad have moved out and the teenage kids have created a party pad, or they're letting people take out the appliances, the six-panel doors, you know, really nice houses going to really crappy houses. And what I'm wondering is, how often is receivership used in situations like that, and is it very fast? Because the neighbors in the neighborhood are asking, you know, what are the remedies in Minnesota law that protect the degradation of the property in our community? And I'm just wondering if this is a tool that's used there.
Mr. Bailey.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hortman, it is either never or rarely used in those residential situations. And Mr. Dunleavy, who's here with me, actually practices more in that area than I do, and he confirms what I thought, and that is it's too expensive a process to use in the residential situation, so it's not. Your usual real estate situation is a commercial apartment building or the like.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you. I actually have two questions, Mr. Chair, and actually one question, and just so that I can take a look at it, I'm going to guess, is this something that you passed out?
It was prepared by the Bar Association and passed out. I didn't prepare it, but I'm familiar with it.
Second paragraph down, the fundamental principles used in drafting you talk about number three is limit the new scheme primarily to commercial marriage and marriage dissolution. Could you tell me in the bill where the marriage dissolution is, and I'll look at it a little later. And then the other two is, I have a question, is has it been difficult to remove receivers and replace them in courts? I don't know. I'm just asking that particular question. And the second question is, when you give notice to all creditors, is my memory is foggy, but I think, isn't that, you have to print it in a newspaper for 3 weeks or something like that? Are you changing any of that? Or where could I find that in the bill?
Mr. Bailey.
Two, help me find things, and one, is it tough to get rid of somebody?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, several questions there. The first one had to do with the language called limit the new scheme primarily to commercial matters and marriage dissolutions. That's a real shorthand. The bill has a long list in Section 2 of the statutes that reference receivers where it's intended to apply. And the what was really meant to be conveyed here was the negative, and that is that there was no intention to get into those kinds of receiverships that involve state agencies, as I mentioned, insurance companies, banks, and so on. Wherever the state is the receiver or appoints the receiver, we've been explicit that this statute would not apply. And that's really all that's meant to convey. It's really much too general, I think, to get to your question. There is no specific reference in this statute to marriage dissolutions, unless it's in that section, too. I'd have to look back.
I'll look at it.
It gets mentioned because it happens now and then, and the receivers that sat on our committee are fairly often appointed by a court when one party in the dissolution process is not obeying court orders. So somebody won't turn over the snowmobiles or whatever, is still using the property or something like that, then the court will appoint the receiver. But there's nothing peculiar in the mortgage in the marriage process that, about receiverships.
Remove and replace under circumstance.
Oh,
The question was really: is it that difficult, or did it need new language?
There is little or nothing. I think nothing in the existing statutes about the subject. And when we try to be comprehensive and address the question of the appointment of the receiver in the first instance, and the obligation of the receiver to make reports, and the obligation of the receiver to do a final report, for completeness, we went on to the subject of replacing the receiver. Does the old receiver have to give a report? How quickly is the new receiver in possession of the property? What kind of reporting obligations will apply in that situation? So it's really for completeness. I'm not aware of a particular problem, and I don't remember that the existing statutes address it at all.
Representative Mahoney?
I think he's got all the answers.
All right.
Mr. Chair, we have another testifier, Mr. Dunleavy.
Yes, I was just going to ask, does he want to testify, and then we're probably ready to roll.
Mr. Chair, I'm Kevin Dunleavy, and I co-chair the Legislative Committee of the Real Property Section of the State Bar Association, and I've been before this committee quite a bit in the last 3 years dealing with the mortgage foreclosure issues. I'm really only here today to answer any questions that are related to real estate, because I think Mr. Bailey, who is an excellent attorney and a former president of the State Bar Association, has spoken very eloquently on the topic.
Any questions, members? Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With regard to, I don't know who can best answer this, but with regard to Section 7 of the bill on page 9, which requires the receiver post a bond, could you just talk a little bit about how this is a change from existing practice, to what extent it is, and why you believe the change is needed?
Mr. Bailey or
Mr. Chair, I'll take the question, Representative. The existing statute does not address the issue of a bond. The Rule 137 of the Special Rules of the District Court says that there shall be a bond. Very common practice in Minnesota is for the court to issue an order waiving the bond. We had considerable discussion in our committee about what would be the better practice in that situation, and there's a very good argument to be made that it's a good practice to waive the bond and therefore reduce the costs of the receivership as a whole. But after a lot of discussion, our group felt that that was not a good practice and that the statute should provide that a bond should be required. If the judge decides that the bond should be small, either because the matter is small or because the receiver has demonstrated financial capability, that the judge can make that decision. But there is a change, in effect, in the law here, in that a bond would be required. As I say, it's in the rule, but it's not regularly followed. We have these rules of practice. They're obviously very old. And we found very consistently that the judges, the court administrators, and the lawyers were not following that because it wasn't thought to be good description of good practice. So that's why we addressed those issues.
Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this would, just so I'm understanding you correctly, the bill does eliminate any possibility of waiver of a bond for a receiver.
That's what we intended.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Bailey, on that matter, good question, I think, by Representative Wardlow. What does a bond cost typically in these situations? And I'm familiar in some cases where small businesses are trying to contract with the DNR or the Department of Transportation. Periodically hear about the bond requirement is what basically locks them out of business, and they just aren't financially big enough to have a bond that's sometimes blanket size bond required by the state agencies. I guess I'd have concerns that maybe that same phenomenon would occur in this situation if it's limiting. What are the costs and what are your thoughts?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to start that and then ask Mr. Dunleavy to answer the first part of your question about costs. I think he has more experience with that than I do. But in all situations, the court could order a nominal bond amounting to only a few hundred or a few thousand dollars. So that I think that in the kind of situation you described, a state agency, although that wouldn't be covered by our bill in any event, a state agency is the... Well, no, I would back up on that. I guess there can be circumstances which a state agency was seeking a receiver but did not have the power to appoint the receiver, and then our statute might apply. But the court can decide that the bond amount is relatively nominal, so I think the cost would be low. But Mr. Dunleavy can probably answer better on that.
Mr. Chair, in the cases where I've gotten bonds for receivers lately, they've ranged from maybe $250,000 to $10,000 for bonds in the range of a $50,000 to $100,000 bond. And it really, it's essentially the bonding company is looking at the financial strength of the person it's seeking the bond. So the stronger the financial capability of the person requesting the bond, the less it's going to cost.
So can you repeat that number again? I thought I first heard $250,000.
Maybe I said it wrong, but I meant $2,500 to $10,000 for a bond in the $50,000 to $100,000 range.
Okay, so they're quite expensive. But, I mean, in that case, you're talking 2.5% to, or probably 5% to 10% of the value of the bond.
In the receivership, the cost of the bond comes out of the property, so the receiver doesn't actually pay the bond. But the bonding company does look at the financial strength of the receiver because they're more comfortable with the receiver that's got a stronger financial strength.
If I might add to that, the $2,500 example at the lower end could be lower yet. If the court said, we really don't need much of a bond here, I understand there's a requirement, so my bond requirement is $1,000 or some such. That would be permissible as long as the court makes that decision as a conscious process. But we wanted to stop the process of having receivers appointed without bond, without really thought addressed it to the subject. And there are many examples of situations where receivers or trustees or whatever have, you know, have absconded to funds to the embarrassment of everyone involved.
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wanted to ask, I mean, apparently we've been under common law in this whole matter in the past somewhat, and are we going to be sacrificing any expedience, you know, in terms of transferring properties? I mean, that is a terribly very high priority, and if we formalize this now, are we going to be losing some of that quickness?
Mr. Bailey or Mr. Dunleavy?
Mr. Chair and Representative, there are several aspects to that question. One is an advantage of the common law is that the law can develop to meet the circumstances of the situation, and the receivership law has been developing over 400 or 500 years, and we tried to be clear here that we had no intention of stopping that process. So the description of the circumstances where receivers can be appointed is meant to be non-exclusive, and in all of the processes we tried ultimately to leave it to the judge's discretion. If you take almost any topic, we tried to give some guidance as to the kinds of things that needed to be addressed, but not to limit the judge's discretion. And so if we get to situations right, like reports, for example, the judge can order that only one report be needed filed, or that they be filed weekly, whatever is appropriate to the circumstances. So there's meant to be flexibility. In terms of the transfer of property, in the normal mortgage foreclosure process, there won't be a receiver, so the process isn't going to be affected by that. If there is a receiver and the process, the foreclosure process continues, the receiver will only have been temporarily in possession, and so the appointment of the receiver won't slow the process down either. The change in ownership will occur through the foreclosure process. There are circumstances where the receiver might be the seller of property, and we have addressed, given a good deal of thought, to the process by which a court order would be issued, which would be acceptable to title insurers to permit the free transfer of that property.
Mr. Chair, could I follow up on that?
Mr. Dunleavy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, I had a receiver appointed recently on a five-building commercial property in Osseo, and it took probably 2 months of wrangling among the attorneys before we finally got an order that the parties could agree on. And I think this bill would eliminate a lot of that wrangling among the attorneys in order to get the process to move more quickly.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, thank you for that. Just a follow-up. There's several references to any parties of interest, and is in any way this law, does it disadvantage the secured creditors, you know, in relation to unsecured creditors?
Mr. Chair, Representative,
I
don't believe that it will disadvantage secured creditors at all. We spent a good deal of time on the concept of parties in interest, because if you think of a mortgage foreclosure on one end, which we called which you might call a custodial receivership, the number of parties interested in that process is a relatively small number. The holders of any mortgages, mechanics liens, or other interests in that property are parties in interest in the sense that they are going to be affected by the outcome. They should get notice of the case. They should have the opportunity to participate in any of the hearings. If you go to the other end of the spectrum, if you take a Petter situation, where there are thousands and thousands of unsecured creditors who will ultimately receive some kind of distribution. They should receive some form of notice of the proceeding. They should have some opportunities to be heard in that proceeding. There needs to be a way to identify who are the parties of in interest and how should they be noticed. Once they're noticed, what are their rights to participate in the judicial procedure? So that's what we wrestled with in this bill, and that's the words party in interest are sort of a signal to all of those issues.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Bailey, or actually Mr. Dunleavy, back to your question on the bail or the bond. Are you familiar with any time somebody's turned in a bond and gotten paid?
I have not, Mr. Chair, I have not been involved in a situation where there was a claim on a bond, but I do know that you can sometimes get a refund on the bond at the end of the period if you haven't used it. If the bond is for 1 year and you don't use it for the whole year, you can get a slight refund on it when you turn it back to the bonding company.
And the reason I ask, I think in the instance of a lot of bonds, I mean, we have looked at stuff around here at this, on projects that have gone awry at the state with veterans' homes, with road projects, and I mean, the common understanding of bonds is the bond company is the only one that makes out because nobody's ever turning in a claim against the bond companies. And so I ask that and ask you then, is it really that important to make a bond in every case required when nobody's really collecting on bonds anyways? I'd like somebody to bring forward evidence that the state or companies really go after the bond companies. It seems like they're basically just kind of comfort processes that never have to pay up anyways. What's your thoughts or comments?
Mr. Chair, I haven't been personally involved, but I am aware, I'm a real estate attorney, and so I see things with title companies. And title companies have fidelity bonds, and there are oftentimes situations where there's what's called a defalcation, where a closing agent essentially runs away with the money. I had a case like that with an attorney that ran away with the money, $2.5 million in Mata Midai. And in those situations, there are claims I know of on fidelity bonds. In a receivership scenario, the receivership bond protects a number of people. It protects the debtor, it protects the lender, and I think it also protects the court to a certain extent. And the reason for it is, I'm not aware of it happening in Minnesota, but there are cases where the receivers have run away with the money, just like the title company attorney that I was telling you about. And generally speaking, the cost of the bond is, I would consider, fairly nominal in relationship to the value of the property that we're talking about in apartment buildings and strip malls and things like that. And since the cost of the bond gets paid out of the property and doesn't get paid by the receiver, in a lot of ways it's coming out of what the lender would end up getting as opposed to if there wasn't a bond.
But Mr. Dunleavy, aren't we also, I mean, usually we're dealing with a distressed situation, so there's not enough cash or asset to go around here, and now if we're taking another 5 to 10% out just to pay a bond company, aren't we just making the situation potentially worse by requiring it in most cases here? I mean, if you're the lender, if you're I'm just thinking there's got to be situations where it wouldn't pay to drain the value of the property or the estate or whatever they're handling another 5 or 10% by just paying it to a bond company, assuming nobody's going to run off with it. But aren't we basically devaluing the situation another 5 or 10% by requiring it?
Mr. Chair, it wouldn't be 5 or 10% of the value of the property. The bond amount is typically in apartment receiverships, it would typically be for the amount of a month's cash flow of the property. The other thought that I'd like to convey, Mr. Chair, is that it's not that we're looking for a big bond here. That's not what our focus is. What we're focusing on is we want the receiver to be bondable. We want the receiver to be capable of being bonded, mostly for a matter of fidelity. That's the primary reason. So it doesn't have to be a huge bond, just as long as the person is bondable.
Mr. Chair, I might add that there are many of the members of our committee most regularly represent banks and secured lenders, and I think that after our discussion, there was a consensus on the group that there isn't a group within our group who didn't think we should have a bond so that we could save funds in the process. And I would emphasize again, I think there would be nothing wrong with a court ordering a bond of $1,000 or some relatively nominal amount, which a bonding company would issue for a low cost, especially if it was covered by a letter of credit or something. So I think the cost can be held to a very minimal amount.
Any other members have questions? I know Mr. Gehring has got potentially a small oral amendment. If anybody else has concerns about this, we can continue the discussion. Otherwise, if not, any other questions, members? Do you have any other testifiers, Representative Hoppe?
No, Mr. Chair. I think we're good to go.
Okay. Is there anybody in the audience that wants to testify for or against this bill or about this on this bill? Seeing none, any further discussion, members? Seeing none, we'll proceed to vote. All those in favor of House File...
Mr. Chair?
Oh, Representative Hilty.
Didn't you mention that Mr. Gehring had an amendment?
Oh, Mr. Hilty, Representative Hilty, I only have members had a concern. If I'm the only one with a concern, it's not that major of a concern. And so I just wanted to measure members' interest. Maybe it's not worth discussing any further is my point, Representative Hilty, but if you wanted to hear it, I can have Mr. Gehring suggest what would be an easy fix potentially, but Mr. Gehring, why don't you share it with Representative Hilty and the committee?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the amendment that you were discussing would shift the bond to being a mandatory bond to a discretionary bond. So on page 9, line 25, after shall, you would insert comma, if ordered by the court, comma. So that whole sentence would read, after appointment, a receiver shall, if ordered by the court, give a bond in the sum, nature, and with the conditions that the court shall order in its discretion, consistent with section 574.11.
Representative Hilty, or any comments, members?
Well, Mr. Chair, that would seem to go against what the one of the intentions of the authors of the bill. I was just curious as to what it was that you were referring to.
Okay.
Certainly not advocating it.
Yeah. And essentially, Representative Hilty, I think it would shift it from the courts could waive it to the courts could order it, and the default would be the waive instead of ordering. But if nobody else has concerns on that, I'm not going to offer it myself. Representative Wardlow?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one more question, perhaps. Section 7 with regard to the bond references Section 574.11, that the receiver's bonds run to the state, which reads, bonds given by receivers and trustees appointed by the district court in any action or proceeding shall run to the state of Minnesota for the benefit of all persons in interest. Any person interested may maintain an action in the person's own name upon any such bond. A question, kind of a two-part question, I guess. Does this statute here, 574.11, go to the amount of the bond insofar as it calls for the bond to run to the state of Minnesota for the benefit of all persons in interest? Does that affect how large the bond has to be?
Mr. Bailey or Dunleavy?
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, we don't understand it that way. It's just a reference to how the bonds work, and there's nothing in what you described that I would interpret as affecting the question of the size of the bond.
So Mr. Bailey, may I ask your reaction to shifting it to a option for the court to order versus not have it versus them ordering the waive? Do you have any reaction to that oral amendment if it was offered?
Mr. Chair, if I might.
Representative Hoppe.
You know, we've had, thank you, Mr. Chair, we've had, the Bar Association Committee has had, what was the number of meetings?
18.
18 meetings and gone through this at a fairly detailed level. And I think maybe if you and I and Mr. Lake want to have a discussion about this outside of after this committee and talk more over it, because we need to address your concerns, but if we could, I would prefer to leave the bill unamended at this point.
Sure. Okay. Any other comments, members? Questions? Representative Wardlow, you got yours answered.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Seeing none, having no further testimony, the chair will renew Representative Hoppe renews his motion that the bill be passed and re-referred to the Judiciary Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Members, that's it for the agenda today. Wednesday we will be back. Representative Wardlow's bill and some others will be up, Bruce Anderson, and look at the agenda. Meeting is adjourned.